You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are at Beaconsfield Services on the M40.
Takes us to some glamorous places, the podcast, doesn't it?
It does indeed. But we've had a very important mission this morning. Lots of sporting deals are done at service stations, aren't they? Certainly in football.
Certainly in cycling as well, I believe. Brown envelopes changing hands.
Well, envelopes have changed hands this morning, haven't they? Because you delivered a whole batch of signed copies of the Grand Tour Diaries, signed by yourself and Daniel, which I will add my signature to, and post off to friends of the podcast who have overpaid and are therefore eligible for a copy of the Grand Tour Diaries, which will arrive in the post.
All corners of the globe. I've been writing out these envelopes as the people have been signing up as friends of the podcast. We've got lots of listeners in America, which we knew, but to see the addresses, to see where these books are going to is mind-blowing, actually. Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia, all over Europe, but about 50% going to the US. So thank you very much to all of you who have paid a bit extra to become a friend of the podcast and will receive very soon a signed copy of the book.
But we didn't just meet here at random, did we, at a service station on the M40?
No, we didn't. You were in the vicinity, Lionel, on a secret mission.
I was. I was at Bicester Village Retail Outlet, not going Christmas shopping, but going to interview a man who I've long wanted to meet and interview for the podcast, but hadn't got round to. Finally managed to find some time in his diary. And
are you going to tell us who it was at any point?
I am, Richard.
It was Rebecca Vardy.
It wasn't Rebecca Vardy, no. It was Flavio Zappi, the former Italian professional rider who was second in the King of the Mountains at the 1984 Giro d'Italia.
It's one of the flattest Giro in history, famously.
Well, funnily enough, that does come up. I had wrongly thought that Zappi was a handy climber, which he obviously was, but he was much more of a sprinter, something that I didn't really appreciate fully until we had our conversation this morning. He also finished 12th in Milan San Remo and didn't have a long career, but we've talked about why his racing career ended a little bit prematurely and how he got back into cycling over here in the UK. It won't take a linguist of Daniel Freeb's standing to work out that Flavio Zappi is Italian, but he now lives in Oxfordshire, has done for 25 years, and a lot of people may well be more familiar with him because he's put his name to the Zappi junior and under 23 development teams. And the most famous to date, most famous rider to graduate from his program is James Knox, who went via Wiggins to the Quickstep Floors team, now De Koenig Quickstep, of course, and who had an excellent Vuelta a España, kept an audio diary for us, of course, during the Vuelta. We talk a little bit about James Knox. Now, unfortunately, this morning when I met up with Flavio, I had the most calamitous introduction, probably the second most embarrassing moment of my year so far.
Hey,
piacere, Flavio.
Ciao, piacere.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Hi. Oh no.
Did you get that?
I did get that. So as you can imagine, Richard, a week before Christmas, Bicester Village Retail Outlet was quite busy. There was a long queue to get into the car park. I'd arrived in good time, but was put behind and was rushing a bit. And as I entered the Rafa Cafe where we had arranged to meet, Flavio introduced me to the man he was with, who was Paul Quarterman, the father of Charlie Quarterman, another rider who's graduated from the Zappi team and is, as we speak, in Sicily with Trek Segafredo, training with Vincenzo Nibali and Mads Pedersen, the new world champion, of course. As Paul stood up to shake my hand, I knocked over a tall glass of water. The water went all over Paul's trousers. A small coffee, an espresso, naturally, went all over Flavio's trousers. And I cracked a small Rafa espresso cup. It was pretty embarrassing. I'm glad I wasn't wearing a sort of cycling podcast t-shirt to identify myself, but perhaps the microphone gave me away. But yeah, a blundering, calamitous introduction.
Oh, that's fantastic. Very smooth indeed, Lionel. I know you've been working on that. We should explain that the off-season, of course, I mean, you mentioned Daniel Freeb. He's not with us because we're doing a few slightly different episodes. Last week we had a chat with Ian Boswell, Larry Warbass and Joe Dombrowski in Nice. We've followed those guys through their career, so we caught up with them again. And this week again, something a bit different. And the off-season is an opportunity to do that. And also a very elaborate way for you to avoid the news roundup, Lionel.
Well, yes, but the news roundup will return in the new year when we're good and ready. But yeah, there has been some cycling news that we'll update people on, but that can wait until after Christmas. We're doing something slightly different. And well, my conversation with Flavio covers his own career, which I didn't know too much about. I knew kind of the headlines, but it was great to talk to him in the first half about his own career, and then in the second half talk about his how he came to England and his attitude towards developing young riders. And ensuring that they're equipped to make a career as a professional, not just get that first contract.
The fastest clothing in the world tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor these last 3.5 years. You were in the Rafa Cafe earlier today, Lionel. We're about to cross back over there, but we said a couple of weeks ago that our relationship with Rafa will end at the end of this year. So I think this is the penultimate regular episode, title sponsored by Rafa. But again, we're incredibly grateful to Rafa for their support, which has allowed us to grow and develop the podcast and produce spin-off podcasts, the latest of which, Service Course, is out later this week with Tom Wally and Lizzie Banks. Listen out for that. So we're very, very grateful indeed to Rafa for all their support. And if you want to support the podcast, you can, of course, sign up as a friend. We've just launched our new Friends program for 2020. Episode 1 is The Stage That Didn't End, and it's a look back at stage 19 of this year's Tour de France, the first part of which looks at the events surrounding the cancellation of the stage when there was a hailstorm and a landslide. And the second part is an interview with Egan Bernal, who, of course, took the yellow jersey that day and went on to win the Tour, and some of the people around him. So it's a podcast in two parts. Later this week, or at the start of next week, episode 2 for Friends of the Podcast will be a mashup of our live shows and our recent Grand Tour. And then episode 3 will be the Giro d'Italia Diaries. And if you sign up as a friend of the podcast, it's £15 for the year. If you pay a bit more and become a good friend or a best friend, you will get a signed copy of the book. And if you become a friend of the podcast at the standard rate, you will also be eligible for a 20% discount on the cover price of the book. And you'll still get the book in time for Christmas if you order it now, we think. So go to thecyclingpodcast.com/book to buy the book, or thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe to become a friend of the podcast.
As you say, Rich, we've frozen the price at £15 for the year. Just one quick technical mention for those existing friends of the podcast, just to make it very clear that this is a new system. It's not, doesn't run with the same password or anything as your old friends of the podcast system, so you don't need the old podcast password or anything like that. All you need to sign up is your email address and a credit or debit card, and it's as easy as 1, 2, 3. But let's go over to the Rafa Cafe at the Bicester Village retail outlet for my conversation with Flavio Zappi. Well, happy Christmas, Flavio. Nice to finally meet you. I must apologise about my clumsy entrance there. I spilled water all over the table. It's been a long season. That's all I can say. That's all I can say by way of an apology. But great to finally get you on the podcast. And just first of all, introduce who else is with us here today, please.
Yeah, Paul Quarterman is a very good friend of mine, and has been involved in developing the club, Zappi Cycling Club, at the beginning, now the racing team and the junior team specifically with me for the last 7 years. I think he's a good giving back to him as well, not just always in the behind my aura kind of thing. So that's why I wanted him to be around with us today.
Well, nice to meet you. Of course, your son is, he's off, joined up with the Trek Segafredo team very recently.
Yes, yeah, Charlie, well, first of all, started out with Zappi several years ago as a youth, through the junior ranks, raced last year as an under 23 with Flavio in Italy, including the Giro, baby Giro. And now, you know, it's been a really good good year, and he's riding with Trek Segafredo now. So, new adventure.
How did he get on in the Giro? Tell us.
He had two really quite good results. He got a fourth place in the prologue, and was only, I think, 1.6 seconds off winning position. So that was a really good result for him, and he got to wear a jersey, which was great. And then I think stage 7 or 8. There was a breakaway down the road with about 20k to go. He bridged across to it, and from that managed to eke out third place, which was probably quite a spectacular result, really, and caught the eye of the World Tour teams and agents, and that's where the success really came from.
And he's currently training with the team before Christmas, and then coming home for Christmas, and then going off for another block of training before the race starts.
Yeah, that's right. So he's out in Sicily right now, training with most of the Trek Segafredo team, including the women's team. Actually, they're all training together down there. There's a group out in Australia now, preparing for the Tour Down Under, including Richie Porte. But the rest are in Sicily. They come back Christmas, New Year, and then they're out to Mallorca for another block of training, followed by races.
Well, Flavio, your team is, you know, developing riders and a couple of high-profile names now. We'll talk about James Knox a little bit later on, but he came through your system on his way to the World Tour. But I wanted to start by asking you about your cycling career. And first of all, I guess you're obviously not you're not from Oxfordshire. You're from Italy originally. Whereabouts are you from in Italy?
I grew up near Varese, so just below the mountains. North Milan, although my family originally is from Romagna, so near Pantani specifically, so the blood is there from that area. I grew up there cycling wise, as I said, in Varese area. That's where I started my career. I got pro eventually after 6-7 years of all the youth and junior level and under 23. Picked a few results, nothing spectacular. I did only 4 or 5 years, and just before the very famous infamous using of the stuff which I spotted at the time, I managed to get out of the system, and I stayed away from cycling for 15 years, almost sick of the whole system. But then eventually he came back to me, and I felt like I need to give back to some of those boys. And being living in England, my wife is English, and I settled here 25 years ago. I kind of feel like I can give opportunities and knowledge I got to those boys.
Well, come on to that a little bit, but Varese, certainly in the 90s, was kind of the home base for so many pro riders, wasn't it? Was it the same in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, when you were making your way into the pro ranks?
Oh, definitely. And when I was a junior, there was a place where we used to go out and meet for a training on a big training day, Wednesday or Thursday, and that was Gallarate near Malpensa Airport, and that's where all the pro used to be there. So for us, all the boys were so excited to be there at 9 o'clock and see Giuseppe Saroni, Panizza, all the big names in the area, and train with them. And, you know, and that was 200 kilometers, and that was no food in the pocket, and there was one bottle cage, and 53-15.
I'm going to interject at this point, because I remember Flavio telling me he grew up in a hotel, family run hotel, with his family, just outside of Varese. And I remember Flavio telling me that the Colombian nationals team stayed in the hotel one time, and Flavio was down in the basement, grabbed one of their bikes and went off for a ride, and that was part of his discovery of cycling.
So cycling wasn't in your family, you know, with your father or your parents or your grandfather or anything like this? It was something that you discovered on your own?
No, that was totally my older brother's passion. My older brother's passion for cycling was unbelievable. He was a chef in our restaurant, when he was like 16, working in the kitchen, he managed to ask my dad, could go and buy some fish somewhere, and while he was traveling on his bike near Gallarate, there was a big bike race going through, and he just followed them, just to give you that. And then he stayed away for like 6 hours, came back, got a big little kick in his bottom, and but that was his passion. And when as Paul was saying, the Colombian team came into our hotel in 1974 during the World Championship in Varese. The road championship was in Switzerland, but the track was in Varese because there was a track. Colombian team won the pursuit with coaches Rodriguez. So in the morning they were training on the road. In the afternoon it goes on the track. So my brother came to say, "Hey, there are some lovely bicycle downstairs in the garage." So we went off and ride, and I remember the sensation of the speed, and I thought, I quite like this. And I started. That was when I started.
So how did you make the transition from just being interested in cycling and doing it as a pastime to realizing that you were quite good at it and could start racing?
It was literally immediate. There was definitely some power there, I guess. And straight away from the first few races, that I started picking up results as a youth, and of course the passion of the small clubs in the area, with a lot of old people really into cycling, they fueled the passion to me, and it went from then onwards literally.
And were you quite quickly better than your brother?
No, my brother never had to race or train. He was. First of all, he's 15 years older than me, and for him, would just follow me. So he was there with this 70s cam video. I got incredible footage still in the loft, and he was doing my massage eventually. He was looking after my diet. He was pretty much my coach.
So he was a fan, really. He'd be watching the Giro on TV and the classics on TV. That was what kind of drew you in.
Yes, he was that, basically.
And when you turned professional, I mean, just describe what the Italian scene was like then, because there were so many professional cycling teams in Italy at that time, weren't there? It was a really thriving world, but it was also quite a closed world in that there was such a domestic scene of racing, I guess. You probably didn't need to leave Italy to have a full race program all year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember the major nation was Italy, France, Belgium, a bit of Dutch, and a bit of Americans. There was hardly anybody else in other than those nations, and therefore Italy was a big calendar. We also did the Tour of Switzerland, the Belgium Classics, some Belgium races, French races, but nothing much more than that. Obviously, there was also Spanish rider as well. It feels like it, in a way, was kind of easier to get into the pro scene, but there was also a lot of riders in Italy at the time. I mean, I remember back in my days as a junior, there was easy in my area 10 races with 200 people there. So making it wasn't that easy.
And I guess the teams were quite small as well, maybe sort of 12 or 13, 14 riders, so not quite the same size of organisations as we have today.
Correct, 12 riders, no more. That was the maximum.
So you turned pro in what, 1981?
Correct, yeah, 1981, after 2 years under 23.
And what was your first team like? Was it as glamorous as it looked on the TV?
No, it was one of the medium level. Not, you know, the top level at the time was Del Tongo, was Bianchi Piaggio with Tommy Prim and Contini, all these people. So we were like, and also we were also a little bit underdog because there were 9 out of 12 were new pros. So, you know, we were definitely the one that have to shut up and just get on with the jobs. And it was tough the first few months racing. When we did in Sicily, in Puglia, Tirreno Adriatico, incredible, tough entry into Milan Sanremo. And then from then on, everything got much better. We almost got through that period, and that's where we started really performing. It was Trentino, Giro d'Italia. In fact, we did beautiful result at the Giro as a new pro. We won the team time trial against Francesco Moser's team.
So what was the style of racing like in the early 80s in Italy? Because from when I was growing up reading about cycling, the cliche was that Italian racing was very, very piano for maybe 3 hours and then absolutely insane for 2 hours. Is that how it was?
I did struggle getting into that style. As an amateur, it's like now, it's full on from the gun. And I enjoy that kind of racing. And looking backwards, it probably suited me better to go to race in Belgium, because in Belgium was similar anyway. No, in Italy was, as you said, very slow to start, very slow, and you know, for hours. But the last hour was just awful. You know, in that switch in pace for me, I did struggle.
Why was it? Culturally, was it something about the Italian nature, or is it just the cliche that the TV coverage starts with an hour to go, and that was what sparked everyone into life?
Well, that definitely got a reason. Definitely during the stage of the Giro Italia was like that. The helicopter is arriving, that's it, we're all going, full gas. But in Belgium wasn't. In Belgium was full on all the time, and I enjoy racing there. And also Milan-San Remo, for instance, although it was in Italian, it, maybe because there was 300 riders, 300 kilometers, and all the foreigners are there. So the racing was different, and I enjoyed that kind of racing because of it.
So you had 2 or 3 years just kind of getting to grips with what it meant to be a pro in Italy, and then in 1984 you find yourself in a team with Johan van der Velde and Luciano van Imp. Yes. Who of course, you know, one of the best riders that Belgium has ever produced. Van Impe certainly was coming towards the end of his career by this stage. How did those two riders, a Dutchman and a Belgian, end up in your medium-sized Italian team at that time?
I really don't know, actually. I have to be honest. I came to race to Metaro Mobili Pinarello, that's the team, on the back of a quite difficult year. I almost gave up. I had a bad injury, and I went to surgery, and then I came back, and I lost a little bit of track of the racing season for a year or two. So Metaro Pinarello started the year before, and they obviously had some money, so they obviously, you know, like anything, they start is about investing in and having the money to pay those salaries. Van der Velde, to me, was an incredible rider, fantastic on descending, fantastic sprint climbing. He had everything. Van Impe, of course, the class of a grimper, moody grimper, but very good a climber. And we learn a lot. But don't forget, in that team we have Vittorio Algeri, now director sportivo Michelin. We had Riccardo Magrini, now great. Speaker at Eurosport Italy in Italy, and we had Luciano Borgognoni, and we had a very interesting Luciano Borgognoni the year before, but we had a very good solid older guys there to give that depth.
Because of course Van der Velde, I think, was fifth in that Giro in 84, and Van Impe was seventh, I think, in the same Giro. So you were obviously, you in the team, you had riders who were right up there in the overall. For listeners who aren't familiar perhaps with the names of riders from the 70s and 80s, Van Impe was King of the Mountains in the Tour de France, of course. Van der Velde, Van der Velde had two really good Giro d'Italia in 87 and 88, I think. Might have won the King of the Mountains in one of those years, certainly on the podium at some point. As you say, Flavio, a really ace climber at that time. But you weren't so bad going up hills yourself, were you? That 1984 Giro, you were second in the King of the Mountains competition. I mean, what are your memories thinking back to the 84 Giro and coming so close to winning one of the jerseys? You held it, I think, for a couple of weeks.
Well, I go back a little bit on Van der Velde. Van der Velde, don't forget, he got third at the Tour de France, helping Zotemelk to win it. And on the back of that, he won the national champs road, so was an amazing rider. So for him coming to Italy, everything was definitely, easy in a way, on the back of those results. And for me, it was almost an unexpected result, because my job for that year in that Giro Italia was to go for breakaways. Yes, you're right, we had amazing results as a team. In fact, we won the team classification. And so my job was to go in the breakaway and pick up some money. So sprint competitions, all that kind of stuff. And I do remember exactly when I got the jersey, because I went to this breakaway in down the south of Italy. It was horribly hot. It was probably 40 degrees. I'd never liked the hot weather, despite being Italian. I really hated it. But I was there, and I struggled to give my turns. And luckily, there was this thunderstorm arrived. And I don't know what happened to me, but I literally switched to my level. And there was three climbs on that stage, and I won them. And then the next day, there was another climb, and I was supposed to lead the sprint on the top of the climb for Lucien Van Impe, which was the guy that was supposed to get the jersey. And as was leading out the sprint, I went a bit too hard and I won it. It got really cross with me. I'm not sure. And then I got more points, and then I end up saying, well, I'll just carry on trying to keep it. And I kept it. But to be honest, you know, that Giro was probably the flattest Giro ever in history. So it was still okay, I guess. And then when eventually Laurent Fignon decided to make hold on a second. Okay, when eventually decide to, sorry, that was my phone, when decide to put the hammer down and do what he need to do, which it was to win the Giro, on his way just picked up four mountains.
You say that was a flat Giro. I mean, it's all relative. I mean, Italy is a surprisingly hilly country, especially down in the south. Hills that you wouldn't necessarily know about, when even from looking at the road book, I guess. I mean, it's almost like a country of two halves in a lot of senses. But, of course, that was the year Francesco Moser won the Giro. And I suppose the suspicion was that the course had been designed to give Moser a great time trialist, but not super in the very high mountains, the best possible chance. Is that how you saw it at the time?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there was the everybody was waiting for the second part of the Giro, which didn't happen because there was they have to change the course for whatever reason.
Well, what actually happened? I mean, the story is that the stage to Val Gardena, which would have gone over some big mountains, the climbs were cancelled, but then subsequently the roads were passable. There was no snow on the roads, as people have been led to believe, and Fignon's great chance to overtake Moser was gone.
Absolutely. I'm guessing that's the reason. I mean, I wasn't really, for me, was okay to avoid it. Probably 90% of the peloton at the time, so that was good. It sounds like that way now, you know, looking back. I can see so many strange little things happening in that Giro and in other situations,
such as
I don't know, it's some of them are maybe I got to watch it, I'm not sure if so. I might talk to you another time about it.
By saying that, do you mean there was a very much a hometown feel to the Giro in those days? Having an Italian winner was important to the race organisers?
I guess it was very important. And don't forget, Francesco in that period was the sheriff. He was incredibly powerful, to say the least.
Do you mean on the bike, but off the bike as well?
Yeah, with his teammates. I was sorry for these teammates. One of them was a very good friend of mine, and I really didn't like the way he was treated.
Too severe, too much the boss.
I guess there's a lot of that. And so for the media, for the sponsors, for the organizer, it was good to have Francesco there. Just fresh one. Milan Sanremo and our record on this very unusual new training regime, which was unheard, to win the Milan Sanremo without doing any stage race before, like Tirreno Adriatico or Paris-Nice. So it was something new that happened. We later on find out why.
Well, I think we kind of knew at the time, because the doctors who were part of Moser's preparation team, they were working out in the open, weren't they? They were there in the velodrome when he did the hour record. It wasn't like it was a secret, but I guess people didn't know at the time exactly what the methods were that were going into, you know, some of the performances.
It was legal at the time because nobody knows what was it. So if it's a brand new system, a brand new situation, and it's not on any legal requirement, then you can do it. And they did it. You know, they had the money, the risk, I think. They take a lot of risk. And they got it. They got the results.
But at the time, you know, Moser, he was the boss. It was Moser and Cerrone, wasn't it? The two were the big names, and there was this big rivalry. I mean, was there a sense of excitement at being in amongst and racing in events where, you know, the two biggest stars in the sport and two of the biggest stars in Italian sport, full stop, were competing?
Not really. Not really, because you either with them or you out. There's very difficult, very almost impossible opportunity for you to get results if you are not part of the system, whether you are in their team or whatever. I mean, I had three amazing results in the pre-selection races for the national team selection. As a new pro, I got a fifth, a seventh, and a top 15, which at the time, and nowadays, I would be straight into the national team. But I couldn't, because Moser and Cerrone wanted a seven rider for their own mates.
I guess you can see the logic in that. They'd want people who rode for them all year round to support them in the World Championships. But I guess these are the sort of romantic stories, or the stories that we as non-Italians romanticise about Italian cycling. You know, the splits between the stars and the deals that are done and all of that kind of thing. But from what you're saying, you know, when you're inside that world, it's perhaps not as glamorous, not as exciting as it perhaps appears when the stories take on this kind of mythical aspect that we tend to give them.
Yeah, I mean, for a young rider, it's almost impossible to make it unless you are selling yourself to that situation, and you know, it is quite hard because you're a young rider, you're coming through, you've done incredibly well as an amateur, you're on the top 10, 5 in Italy, in the world, and then all of a sudden you are no one on the other side. So mentally, it makes a massive effect. And to me, definitely made it. I definitely cracked mentally at the time.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting my interview with Flavio Zappi to remind me to tell you that this week's episode is sponsored by Pro Cycling Magazine, the leading magazine covering professional cycling. And all of the Cycling Podcast listeners can get a subscription today and get three issues of Pro Cycling Magazine for £1 with the special code TCP19. I'll give you the website address at the end of this segment so that you can sign up for Pro Cycling Magazine. Plus, you'll also receive the Heroes of Pro Cycling ebook, which ordinarily costs £10. Now, Richard, all three of us have written for Pro Cycling over the years. Daniel, of course, probably most closely associated with the magazine. It's been going for 20 years, and he's written for Pro Cycling almost since the start, whereas you and I have been occasional contributors over the years, haven't we?
He started when he was 8, writing for Pro Cycling, I think. No, he did straight out of university. Daniel was... has been very involved in the sort of evolution of Pro Cycling Magazine over the years, yeah.
And, well, it's edited by Edward Pickering, a long-time colleague of mine, of course. And, well, I look forward to the magazine plopping onto the doormat each month because it's always a good read. And it's a magazine that really feels luxurious to flick through. And just a quick mention for the cover a couple of months ago, which I know Ed was very proud of, because it's a kind of pastiche of the Who's album cover, The Kids Are All Right, featuring Egan Bernal in the Pete Townsend role at the front, Tadej Pogacar, Pavel Sivakov, and Remco Evenepoel. Really kind of
inventive, imaginative cover that was, and that reflects the context.
Do you think any of them will have heard of The Who, or been familiar with the cover?
I think they were all asked, and I think it was a naught for four on that front. Yeah, but they're too young, aren't they? You know, they're too young. But I think that gives the kind of the style of the covers really gives the strongest hint of the quality of the content inside, I think. And even you write for it, Richard, on occasion. So you did a piece about Egan Bernal's Tour de France victory in the most recent edition.
Yeah, and that issue that you mentioned, Lionel, with the focus on the four prodigious young talents. Just one little anecdote, because it's you do get great detail in some of the features in Pro Cycling. It was a Pro Cycling feature in Willie Smith, actually, that inspired a Kilometre Zero at the Vuelta. But there's a piece on Tadej Pogacar in there, and a story concerning the Slovenian national coach, Andrej Hauptmann, who went to watch a race 10 years ago, a kids' race, when he was working for the government. And he says, I turned up a bit late for the race, and the first thing I saw was a big group of teenage riders leading and a small guy, much younger, lagging 100 metres behind, trying to catch up. I said to the organisers, we've got to do something to pace this little guy up to the front again. And they said, no, it's not what you think. He's in front. He's lapped the whole field. And that little guy was Tadej Pogacar, and he was a couple of years younger. He was 10 at the time, and a couple of years younger than all the other riders, and there he was. Lapping the field. So that was a nice little story about his development.
Just shows you don't necessarily have to be a genius to spot talent sometimes. Anyway, if you would like to subscribe to Pro Cycling Magazine and get inside the world's toughest sport, then go to myfavouritemagazines.co.uk/TCP19 and use the code TCP19 to get your discount, which means you subscribe to the magazine and you get the first three issues for only £1, or call 0344 848 2852 if you're in the UK. That's myfavouritemagazines.co.uk/TCP19 and the code TCP19. Just on the 84 Giro, I mean, what was the experience of going to the podium every day, pulling on the, I think, green jersey as King of the Mountains at the time, day after day? I mean, were you building a sort of media profile, getting stories in La Gazzetta dello Sport, or were you still kind of one of the smaller names?
No, I knew it was a bit of a fake glory, you know. Everybody knew I'm a sprinter, I'm not a climber. I just took my chances. I was clever enough to get in the breakaways again. And with my jersey, I had a very good form. I mean, I never remember to feeling so good every single day. And every day was almost, the jerseys give you extra power. Plus, you know, I used to do my gruppetto. Therefore, the next race, I knew when I wanted to go, I had the power to, because I'm a sprinter, I had the power to get a breakaway when I wanted. So everything went perfectly for me. And it was nice to go to get the flowers and the fame, but I knew underneath it was just...
But what was it like? I mean, try to compare to the sort of modern day, because in my head I have a vision of the teams being a little bit like Gianni Savio's team now, you know, having to go out in front, having to, you know, take risks in the race, having to make the race, really. And the riders themselves seeing it as a stepping stone on to maybe the next level.
We were slightly above that. We will definitely had the names to get the results, like, as I said, Wininpe, Van der Velde, but still, we're still pretty much in awe or afraid of some of those big teams. Obviously, they were there all day working and getting the result. I mean, give you an example, one of the things when I look at the races nowadays, they do lead out training of 3K to go. Lead out training back in the day of 25K to go. I mean, Del Tongo was riding in the front for Saroni for at least 25K other stages. And, you know, those, when you see people doing that kind of stuff, you feel, wow, you know.
So from your own career as well, I mean, probably the other standout result would be, I think, 12th place in Milan-San Remo 1 year. Do you remember much about that? Or are there any other standout days that still stick in the memory 30-plus years later?
Well, that one in the Paris-Roubaix was the one that stuck forever, including when I won the Trentino. The Milan-San Remo was a horrible day, wet all day, wet and cold. And I remember, again, it was 300 riders, a lot of fighting on the Turchino, and crashes all over the place coming down the Turchino. And then soon we get into the seaside. Anderson goes away, and the whole Renault chasing a single file for hours. I mean, 7.5 hours racing. And then I was hanging. And then all of a sudden, I don't know what happened, the last hour and a half, when we get to before the final one, what's it called?
So there's the Cipressa, and then the Poggio, of course, the last one.
Yeah, Cipressa, all of a sudden, I find my legs. I was still suffering the same way, but people were getting dropped. Then I thought, that's interesting. And all of a sudden, I find myself in the top 20. Coming down over the Poggio, on top of the Poggio, I was fifth on the top when Moser attacked on the descent, the Chinetti, nicely giving him a little space and get around the corner. And then, of course, when you get down the Poggio on the last 2 kilometers, Moser would disappeared. We later find out on YouTube. I can tell you, have a look.
I will have a look. Will I have to fill this in for the listeners, or are you going to tell us what happened?
I think it's interesting for you guys to have a look what happened the last 3 kilometers on the 1984 Milan-Sanremo.
Well, we'll talk about that. We'll see if we pick up that. But listeners, there you go. You've got to go to YouTube and look for the 1984 Milan-Sanremo.
Moser attacca. Chinetti forse nella scia di Moser. Eccezionale Chinetti. Oltre bravo Moser, naturalmente, ma in queste condizioni.
Just before we wrap up on your career, tell me a bit about Paris-Roubaix as well, because just to ride on the cobbles in the race itself is an experience that lives with riders and the rest of their lives. Is it the same for you?
Well, I went to Belgium as a first experience in my life. Couple years early when I did the Roubaix already, and I did the last 90 kilometer in the bus sleeping with another 100 riders, because that's what happened. There's a big bus picking up all the riders on the way. But that year I went 2 weeks early with the team. We did a training camp in one of these hotels on the motorway. We raced La Panne, we raced Vevergem, we raced Flandre. And I literally rode on the cobbles previously, properly. And I knew the importance of getting to the Arenberg in the first part of the peloton. And I sprinted. I literally used my sprinting abilities, and I got the top five entering the Arenberg. When I get out, I was away with a minute break. But that's just riding it. But I developed a good quality in the previous races, and from then I had several crashes because it was a wet day again, hanging on the group with Sean Kelly driving it, dropped the wheel for like 10 meters, the thing, Kelly's car go through and make me crash, although I was all over anyway, I was done anyway, but that didn't help. And then eventually managed to finish it with Steven Roach, who did 90% of the job to take me to the velodrome, and I feel really bad, but Stephen, sorry, but I sprinted.
So you let Stephen Roach tow you all the way to the velodrome, and then you pipped him on the line.
I kind of did, but I did help him a little bit. I mean he was so good anyway. I don't think for him wasn't very important to get 18. I was the first of Italian that year. I even got a special interview on Rai Sport, and I was naughty that day.
Well, everyone's done it. I mean, it's fair game, really. You know, you pay the consequences one day later on, I guess. That's how cycling works, isn't it? I mean, from listening to you talking about, you know, your career and how things were going and the passion you have for it now looking back, it's kind of puzzling why it didn't continue on for longer. I mean, tell me about the circumstances that led to you, basically deciding that professional cycling wasn't for you.
I lost the contract after the 1984 Giro, and good result. I had an amazing contract for the year after, 1985, with Morella Rossin. But that's where they started the new coach program with Aldo Sassi at the time, which then funded the MAPEI Sport. very famous, and he led what is now considered the coaching standard. At the time, there was no coaching. He was the first one to start, and he did do this training specific for us, and out of 12 riders, 10 lost the contract the next season. So I went from be out there at the Poggio to not even finishing the races, and they, we reckon a lot was to do with the training. It was very, it was totally different to what we used to, and then Aldo Sassi, rest in peace, Aldo, he also said that they gradually changed the system to make a little bit more effective for cycling. At the time, it was more like athletic.
When you say change, what made the training harder or more specific, or what were the differences?
We do a lot of powerlifting, but not much agility. Therefore, we are very fit lifters, but nothing to do with cycling. So we have no spinning legs, and then later they develop to turn that kind of training, for example, there was other training, to more into cycling, so you can transfer that kind of power you're building into more motion, and now it's a basic standard procedure they do nowadays. And
so he was ahead of his time, but some right, you probably weren't ready for it at that time, or the change was too dramatic at the time.
I think it was a combination of that. It's a radical change. It was also the wrong training for cycling at the time, which then gradually developed more specific. And it did work, but, you know, as I said, 10 out of 12 riders were out. And I lost contract for next season. I lost interest. I was a bit, there was a lot of factors, you know, including what we mentioned earlier. And so on. I decided I wanted to break away from this kind of life.
Well, we'll take a break there, Flavio. I'm going to look at the 1984 Milan Sanremo on YouTube. Maybe we'll get another coffee, and we'll resume in a few minutes.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products. Be a good Christmas present, wouldn't it? Science and Sport goodies at 25% off, even better. You can get 25% more at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. You're looking confused, Lionel.
Yeah, do you get 25% more with a 25% discount? The mathematicians out there will tell us.
25% more in terms of value.
Yes.
At scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. Now back to your very interesting interview with Flavio Zappi.
Well, I've had a look at YouTube, the 1984 Milan Sanremo. I didn't realise it was motor-paced in those days, Flavio.
Yeah,
quite a few motorbikes just as they come off the descent there. I mean, people complain these days, and rightly so, about how close the vehicles get to the riders, not just for influencing the race, but also the safety of the riders. But, I mean, coming down the Via Roma there in 1984, it looks like a different sport. There's probably 7 or 8 motorbikes all circled around Moser, and quite a few cars in the finish straight as well. It really was a different-looking sport in those days.
To be honest, when people were talking about the time, I didn't actually make any notice of it. I thought it was just people talking. It's only recently when I looked more specifically on those channels, those YouTube channels, and looking at the video, thinking, wow, and now knowing how the difference they can make with the aerodynamics, there was definitely something going on there. And I mean, there's no doubt that Francesco was amazing to be out there in that situation. But, you know, that's what happened.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not the only incident in big, big races. I mean, if you spend a lot of time surfing through YouTube looking at races from the 80s and even the 90s, you know, the number of vehicles that are there influencing the results, I guess, or influencing in a way, maybe not changing the results dramatically, perhaps, but we can't know, can we? But that was Italian cycling, and that was cycling in those days. And, well, Flavio, you told me about how the end of your career came. game. But what I don't know is what brought you to England in the first place and why specifically Oxfordshire?
Well, I'm married with a British lady. We settled in Abingdon near Oxford in 1997. And at the time, I was not interested at all in cycling still.
Did you meet in Italy or meet over here? What kind of brought you over?
Would you want to know my love story?
Well, I mean, not in any intimate detail, but I mean, you know, yeah. What kind of got you over to England in the first place?
Yes, I mean, we met in Sicily. It was a love story of the 80s, and then we spent a bit of time in Italy, and then we decided to go to live in England. And back in those days, I was more interested in football. Both of my boys made it into Oxford United Academy, and I used my training skills and lifestyle to them, and for different reasons. One went into music, the other one had an injury, and finished like that. And later on, my dad passed away when I came back to Italy for his funeral. I met a few people I knew from cycling time, and one of them, particularly Andrea Curato, was really fit. And by then, I was pretty much overweight and smoking regularly. And I thought, well, I need to do something about it. I picked up a bike on the skip in Oxford. Cleaned up. It was a Falcon. I liked it because it reminded me back in my days. I put my Oxford United top on and I went up riding with the Oxford University boys, and that's where everything started again. My passion came back. I remember to call my son halfway. Initially, it was literally just go up and down Abingdon to Oxford commuting, just to lose a bit of weight. And then I didn't like people overtake me or drop me. So I said, okay, on the way back, I made a bigger loop. I went down to Whitney and back. And then I called my son one day. I said, I feel the same sensation when I used to train. I like it. And so I started training more and more, started racing. I called BCF. I said, am I too old to race? And they said, no, Malcolm Elliott is still racing. I said, okay, so I raced. I went straight to Cat 1 in 3 months or something like that. And then I start learning about power meters and aerodynamics, all that kind of things, and watts. So I wanted to learn everything. And one day in one of my rides here with the Zappi Club, because I set up a club as well, and one of the university friends of mine said, Flavio's not... And I was showing off a little bit about my power on this climb for some reason. Like you do when you have these gadgets, isn't it? Like it makes any difference, really. But anyway, I was saying that to him, and he said, Flavio, it's not about you anymore. Look at those boys in the back of this group. And it made me think. So I started put more attention to those boys. One of them was Charlie Quarterman. And it started from there. It's my life.
I can't let you mention football without asking who is your team back in Italy?
Used to be AC Milan, is not anymore.
Your boys playing football, did you go to watch them play, go and watch the first team play at Oxford?
Oh yeah, I was thinking at one point, I was putting together a team myself. I've been a manager myself. I really loved it. I was there training 3-4 times a week, where the Oxford United guys, they were only training once a week. I said, that's not possible. I mean, we were coming from Italy, training... playing for big teams in Italy, the standard of a training was completely different there. And I thought, no, I wanna do the Italian way. And I was incredibly involved in that.
But then getting back into cycling and realizing that you still felt the same sensations that you had when you were a pro rider. At what point, I'm just curious, when you're riding with these university students, at what point did you volunteer the information that you'd ridden the Giro d'Italia and Paris-Roubaix and Milan-San Remo, or did you keep that on the down low initially?
No, I didn't say anything. They discovered themselves, and then they said, oh, but now I know why. And I used to ride, I remember, this Falcon bike with not even clip-on pedals, just literally my gym shoes and my football top on and just a pair of jeans. and those guys, they were all there with the proper gears, and that was funny.
And then you were racing and enjoying the thrill of racing, but also, as you said, you know, taking an interest in the development of young British riders. I mean, this would have been, I guess, around a time when cycling was beginning to boom in the UK.
Yes, and the first thing I did was to set up a team where I used to race on, but also have riders to race with me, and my idea was to coach on the peloton, so even further from the car. And to be honest, in England is the only way you can do it, because there's no way you can be in a convoy. There's no convoy. And
so you were like the player manager, really?
Yeah. So I had very good riders with me. You probably heard about Will Fox and Dexter Gardias. That's what one of them was. Oh God, and now he's an incredible triathlete. Damn, I don't remember his name now. I can't believe that. Anyway, we had some interesting experience in Belgium with them, and then gradually I got more riders, and then eventually I used not racing anymore but training with them. Then I had a bad accident in Portugal when I almost lost my life, cracking my neck, and then decided eventually to stay in the car only. And every year, just more and more riders, basically, and gradually better.
Tell me about the accident, because I didn't know about that. You, it was on your bike?
Yeah, it was on my bike, and just a little Saturday ride before the race, and I just lost my bar. I went down my neck, my head, and I concertina my back, and I broke my C2, which is normally called the hangman fracture. And I just remember the name, Joe Skipper. Joe Skipper was one of my boys. He's now one of the top triathletes in the world. I think he won top 10 at Kona and all that kind of stuff. I cracked my neck. Luckily, my wife made an insurance for me to be repatriated in UK. Got repatriated because in Portugal I didn't know what to do.
I think the riders saved your life that day, though, didn't they? The guys that you're out training with, Noxie was there, I remember for sure.
Dan Pearson. It was Dan Pearson that Dan Pearson. Told me at the time, said, "Don't move your neck, don't move your head at all." And I think that was determined. And the paramedics arrived as well, really look after me really well at the time. But still, they didn't know what the next story was. So luckily, I flew back to UK, and here I was. I went to surgery the next day, and they fixed my neck. Yeah.
And tell me about the idea of the team, because obviously initially was it just local riders from sort of Oxfordshire, and then you started looking further afield, and then you developed a reputation for being an organisation that could give people an experience racing overseas, and I guess that went step by step.
Yes, it went gradually more and more. So we started with the first team just riding together in UK, some races in Belgium, some kermesses, come back. The next year, it was a little bit more, do maybe a couple of weeks in Portugal training, and then another couple of weeks racing in Italy. And then the year after, said, well, actually, we spend a little bit more time in Italy, and now we literally are all the time away. And the purpose is that create a more general feel of what is European calendar, is more opportunity, higher level, higher standard, safety. Because one of the things which I didn't like much about racing in the UK was the open roads. Still don't like it. But it was difficult. It still is. Mainly because I can't get any sponsorship. Main sponsorship. I mean, Paul has been probably my biggest sponsor throughout this period. Reasons from UK potential sponsor. Well, you're never here. If I'm in Italy, well, you're British. And so on. But my purpose was to give them the opportunity to race in Italy, in Spain, in Belgium, in France, to give the proper European level standard.
If I could just bring Paul in here, Flavio mentioned your backing of the team. I mean, what's in it for you? Obviously, your son's a talented cyclist, reached a World Tour team for 2020, but initially you can't have known that would necessarily be the path that he would be on.
No, that's true. I've always been interested in cycling anyway. I never raced. Well, I did race for a couple of years, but never raced properly, and left me with a feeling that I wished I had, for one thing. So I live vicariously now. I suppose what really happened, though, was that when I met Flavio and got involved with the Zappi Club and then with the Zappi Racing Team, it coincided with a time when I'd just finished, I'd sold a business basically and just finished working full time with that, and I was looking for something new to get engaged with, and met Flavio, and we became buddies. And it's not just about commercial sponsorship, it's about our friendship. It's about the fact that I buy into helping young people, young riders to develop and all of that. There's no commercial gain in it for me personally, but it's about doing something good and giving something back and putting my energies into something new and exciting.
And I guess also as a parent, you know, there's a huge amount of trust involved when you're sending a son or daughter away to race, to go to training camps and into, you know, what is a very demanding and sometimes dangerous world.
Yeah, that's true, actually. I, like most parents, I didn't really dwell on that, though, to be honest. You know, I trusted Flavio, and I trusted the guys that work with Flavio and the supporters that have been there along the way. That's not really been an issue. I mean, there have been a few knocks and bruises and scrapes along the way, and sometimes that amazes me that parents entrust us with their 16 to 18-year-old kids when we take them to Belgium and they race in the junior classics and they come back with broken collarbones and whatnot. But yeah, that's part and parcel of the sport, isn't it? And we do our best to mitigate that and work with the parents and keep them in the loop so they know what's going on.
Is that something you're aware of as well? You know, parents are trusting their children to you, you know, when they're on the cusp of adulthood, but they're still young people.
Well, for me, it would be easier than Paul, because obviously Paul's team 16, 17 and under 18, so there's different, a little bit more responsibility. By the way, in his team, we went through very interesting names, which I'm pretty sure he would be very proud to tell you in a minute. For me, it was a bit more, although they're over 18, they're still very young guys, and the family is a choice where they want to invest the boys' year off education to fulfill a dream. There is a cost in there involving that, and that's why I'm linking to the fact that we couldn't get sponsors almost ever. Therefore, the family engaged financially to do this project. They know what it is about. It's about giving the boys opportunity to fulfill the dreams, but at the same time, they have a year out in Europe to learn language, culture, traveling, seeing places, and live as a group. So learning to cook, to wash up, to look after the bike, driving cars, all those kind of things which are important as a development for a human being. And again, like Paul was saying before, it's not been always easy, because some people obviously they struggle. Homesick and so on, but we've got beautiful stories out of that.
I mean, so basically it's a gap year with a difference almost, and a financial commitment from parents on behalf of their children, or if the riders themselves have some money, they can come in. Does it worry you that cycling is a sport that almost self-selecting, in the sense that if you can afford to do it, you can do it, and if you can't, your talent might not be discovered, I guess?
Yes, definitely, but on the same time, I got no choice. And there are, when you go to the supermarket, and when you go to the tolls, when you go to the petrol station, you need to fill up the car. And if I got no sponsors, I set up a plan. I've been very honest, very clear. It's written on the contract, it's going to cost this much money. If you want to be involved as a family contribution, you can do that. At the beginning, I have to take whoever believed it. And to be honest, you know, and a lot of people did not believe it at the beginning. But the time showed that, you know, they were getting out a lot of it for the money. And they trusted me, you know. And that's how we operate now. 90% of our budget comes from the family. And I'm very grateful to the trust. Now I got, at the beginning I had 6 riders, now I got 20. At the time I had 10 requests, now I got 60. And it's just be honest, by showing that we're doing 40 UCI races a year, and by showing that we getting people going World Tour or Pro. And but don't forget that at the end of the day, it's always a very small amount of people that are making it. But that's sport. It's nothing to do with what we do or what boys are doing. That's sport. But they always come back with an amazing experience.
So tell me some of the riders who've come through the various stages of the development team and have moved on. I mean, we know James Knox, of course, would be the most famous rider to have come through Zappi's. As I said at the start, riding now for De Koning Quickstep, had an amazing Vuelta at España in the second half of the season this year and looks to be on a very good path. But tell me about some of the other riders who've come through before we talk about James.
Well, we had Dan Pearson. That was the first one, the very first one. To be honest, the very, very first one, probably Dexter Gardias, who decided to be in the domestic scene. I think he had an amazing potential to be abroad, but he didn't have the money to come with me when we started the proper program. So he decided to stay locally. But then what Dan Pearson was the major breakthrough.
He had a year or two at Aqua Blue, didn't he?
Yeah, correct. And then from then, three years at Aqua Blue, and now he's racing for Canyon. I still think he's got an amazing possibility to race abroad, especially for his style of climbing. And then we had several people that went to Conti level, you know, Owen James, for instance, now racing for Swift. There's a whole array of riders which stopped with me and now they're racing a good level in England. Ben Hardy, I even forget now how many we got. Bertie Newey went there. We had Callum Ferguson, which is now my one of my managers, went over there. Will Fox, yeah. But interestingly, before that, with the junior team, and this is what I want to... We set up the junior team to help having a better selection for the under-23 because it was difficult with my program to attract the good talent that were there in UK because obviously it was snatched by at the time JLT or Wiggins or these people, and so we said, oh, we do a junior because then we can graduate, and went over there, but still it worked a little bit. I managed to keep some key riders for next season and this year, which is Mason Holliman. I'll tell you in a minute. But unfortunately, we lost some big names, are we?
Yeah. Coming through the junior ranks, we had, Mark Donovan's probably the most obvious notable, who's now riding with Sunweb, previously with Wiggins. He was a Zappi junior, did really, really well for us actually and got a lot of attention. We would have loved it if he'd have continued through to the under-23 team as well, but you know, Frank, we didn't have the resources to keep him, and I guess Wiggins made him a very attractive offer. For one, Jacques Savignagas was another one who was a Zappi junior, went on to Wiggins and will be with Trinity next year. And then Ben Healy as well was a Zappi junior who rode with us for 2 years. Did a great job, got some really fantastic results actually, all the way through his junior career. Went to Wiggins and will be with Trinity next year. And, you know, I think he won a stage of Tour L'Avenir this year, just gone. So he's got great promise as well. So there have been some, and that's just the name two or three. There's some other great riders that have come through our ranks.
But I guess the whole thing for both of you is that if the end goal is to see young riders achieve their potential and make it as far as they possibly can, if they're only with you for a year or two and move on to somewhere else, that's still the whole point of the team, and you can still go back to you know, to parents and say, well, these riders spent a year or two with us and now look where they are. I guess it all feeds back into to what you've built.
Yeah,
that's absolutely true. I mean, I think, you know, we feel a degree of pride and feel some kind of emotional ownership when riders build and develop and go on to build careers. But for us, it irks slightly if they go to Wiggins or to another British Conti team. We want to keep them if we can and take them right the way through to World Tour, which we've done in the case of Charlie, for example. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see the competitive nature coming through a bit there, Flavio. You want to keep hold of them as long as you can and then plonk them straight into the highest level possible.
Well, basically, it's not so much about being possessive. I think they are so young and so vulnerable for mistakes, which I went through. And I can see those. So when you move in, we've got a very nice junior setup, which is a perfect link into the under-23 to move forwards. To jump into a Conti team as from junior to, let's say, Wiggins or JLT, or FDJ, which is happening, it's got danger, which is you can go through nicely. That's fine in the case of Mark Donovan or who else. It could get worse. It could be you not ready mentally. And spend another couple of years with me, I think it will give the continuity that is what is the purpose, and let them grow physically, let them grow mentally. So when they're moving to race properly, ready for all different levels. We show with Charlie that you don't have to be in a Conti team to make as a world tour. We show that. And
do you think you're helped out by the fact that the trend is that the World Tour teams are looking younger and younger for talent and almost bypassing the under-23 ranks altogether? We were talking to Rod Ellingworth, who's just gone to Bahrain McLaren, saying that, you know, there might not be need for the under-23 level for some riders. They might be actually better served going from, you know, from a lower, more junior level straight into a World Tour setup, as some are doing.
Well, it looks like it's a trend now, isn't it? It did happen back in my days. Myself, I was a pro at 20, not even 20, and we only did 2 years under 23. And the Saroni was 20 when he went pro, and so on. I think it's very commercial. I think it's dangerous. I think it's not for our sport. It maybe works for football or maybe still work for cycling. I mean, in the case of Remco, but Remco is just one off. I think it's too dangerous and it's too risky for the boys not to have developed and therefore to be swapped with the next one. And that's what I don't like. I think we need to allow the boys to mature, to get ready, because some of those boys, which it takes maybe a little bit longer, they might be better. But those guys, they are already now, and then the plateau where they are now. And but that's my point of view, and it's a point of view a lot of older coaches out there in Italy. I think it's a commercial trend.
Did he want to jump in there? I think.
Yeah, I did. I mean, it seems to me that with the quality of coaching is developing so much these days, and I know for sure that at youth and junior level the quality of coaching is there, and kids are taking it so much more seriously at an early stage. There are more young guys being delivered to closer to their potential at an earlier stage. I think that's true for sure, and I can see that with the riders we work with, and I'm aware of the coaching that's going on around them. But I think it's also true that kids can leave the junior ranks and then join a Conti team, for example, and then they can disappear into the ranks because the level of racing is higher, and because they're racing as a team, they don't get the freedom that they might with an under-23 team to learn their craft as racers and to race against their own age group, which is part of the development for most guys, I still think.
Yeah, there's a couple of things we've talked about on the podcast in recent months. One is that young riders of 16, 17, 18, they can see what a pro rider is doing on Strava. They can see what's required, what level those top riders are operating at. Okay, maybe not every interval that they're doing or every training session, but they can get a good idea of what the top riders do, which 20 years ago it wasn't possible. All you had to go on was what was in a cycling magazine, or you know, you might get a little bit of information from an interview with someone. You could sort of build up a training program that mimicked the pros, whereas now scientifically there's a lot more opportunity to mimic and develop, and coaches know that as well and can tailor that for the younger bodies, I guess, the younger riders who are still developing physically. And the other thing is that having a career as a pro rider isn't just about getting that first contract, is it? It's about getting the second one and then making sure you're in a position to get the third one, I guess.
Yeah, I remember to send a message to Theo Kierkegaard, to congratulate him to move to at the time, Team Sky, said, Theo, now forget what you've done so far, just pretend you start all over again. And I said the same thing to James and James Knox. I think it's important they realize that. I went through that. I know exactly what it takes. It's not just getting there. It's stay there. Because those guys, they're there now. They're not going to lose their job. They got family. They're experienced. They're strong riders. They are 30, 35. They're not leaving their spot for you easy. So if you want to take that spot, you need to be really, really strong and really committed, really determined.
So talk to me about James Knox and how he first came onto your radar and what he did with Zappi.
Well, James got through the net of the British Cycling to get like Dan Pearson. At the time, British Cycling was more interested in track talent boys, and obviously those two, they are climbers. So I took him aboard Dan. Through Dan, Dan got me in touch with James. James was at school for first season throughout June, and then from June onwards was with me. You can see straight away when somebody's got that kind of mentality. It doesn't matter what bike, it doesn't matter what clothing, it doesn't matter what he's eating. He just want to get on with the job and just do the training. Never complain. Never had any problem at all. Just work hard and be very positive about it. And that's for me was a perfect fit, because for me in my team at the time especially, it was about the mentality rather than the gadgets, rather than power meter, rather than protein shake, all that kind of thing. For me, it was important for them to set up the foundation of their mentality, you know, to go through any kind of issues without any worries, any believing themselves, and not have the need to have those kind of things to perform. So it was a perfect match. He went straight away incredibly well. To be honest, his first race at the Val d'Aosta, he struggled a bit. He crashed twice and didn't finish it. But that was also an unlucky situation. But then by the end of the season, he was in the top 20 at Piccolo Lombardia as a first year. And that is pretty much a good ticket there.
So did you know then that he had enough to make it into the World Tour level?
I think that's where I really realised there was something special there, really special. And the next season in Portugal, when he was fighting with Wood, at the time racing for Rally in one of the Portuguese races, I said, this is something special, you know. And he proved it. I squeezed him a little bit that season, because he was the top rider every single race. So I wanted so much a result, and he had to give us a result from January all the way to when
I remember being in the car with Flavio for the James's first race with you, which was the UK National Champs in Abergavenny, and we were in the car. James punctured. We got him back on the road, and then I remember you saying to me, "You got to watch that boy. He's going all the way."
Did I?
You did. Yeah. Do you not remember that?
Well, I know he was calling me, Flavio, I'm so busy with school and I haven't got time for training. What shall I do? And I said, well, listen, just go and run. You like your mountains. He's in Cumbria. So he said, just go and run. You got only an hour. Just run on the mountains. And that's what he did, I think. And he came to the national championship with no training at all. And to be honest, if he wasn't for that puncher, he would have finished.
He'd been fell running while he was doing his A-levels, wasn't he? Yeah.
But then he kind of went on, didn't he? But how did the move to the De Koninck Quick-Step team come about after that?
Well, to be honest, he did half a year with me, and then another season with me, and then he went to Wiggins. And that's where he started picking up all the lovely fruit of the garden. Thank you, Wiggins team. But I was very happy because I was there in one of those results. Sad to think about it, because Bjorn is there now, unfortunately. That boy, he won the Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and James got second that day.
This is Bjørg Lambrecht, yeah.
And I was there putting bicycles away in my van, because my team didn't do much great, but I was in the car park. and James Knott just got second for Wiggins, and the first thing he did, he came and looked for me. And he was so happy to tell me that, and I was so happy for him to do it. It doesn't matter what jersey he had on, because he's still my boy, and we're still very much in touch, literally at the Vuelta, literally every evening.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask what your emotions were when the Vuelta was going on, because he kept an audio diary for us during the Vuelta. Every night he'd record a few minutes of his thoughts on the bus, and we really got an insight into the kind of emotional roller coaster of going into the Grand Tour after having had such a disappointing previous Grand Tour experience at the Giro, coming in a little bit uncertain, how would he go? Would he be able to last over the 3 weeks? And then, of course, you know, he was right up in there. Then he got into the echelon on the Guadalajara stage, and I mean, that sounds like one of the hardest days of racing of the year. And then, of course, the final mountain stage. You know, he was almost sort of prodded over the line by Philippe Gilbert, wasn't he? When you were in touch with him, what were you trying to say to him, and how did you feel sitting watching the race on TV?
Well, I'm the first little crack on his confidence was when he crashed the beginning before the Ashman. That's when he said, like, "Oh, I'm just gonna let it go now. Just gonna go for stages." And I said, "Come on, James, come on. 5 minutes. You lost 5 minutes. Nothing in the Vuelta. It's nothing. Just sit in. Just make sure you're okay." And then, of course, the Ashland day went, and he got 10 minutes. So, and then he went from there, more and more excited about being in a GC, because that is a GC rider. He's an amazing GC rider, and it was just beautiful to talk to him and share the emotion. Yeah.
And does it help you that riders are coming through that now are? I mean, you talk about Wiggins enjoying the fruit, but you're planting the seeds, I guess.
Yes, but again, that's why when you're planting the seeds, like with the same comparison, you want to make sure when the tree is just about to grow, you want to keep it safe, because that is also wobbly, isn't it? And that's where the danger is for me when they move into a setup which is very pro, and they then more interesting in other situation. And the fragility of the mentality of the boy needs another year or two to really get in the strength he needs. And that's why before I was mentioning I'm possessive about it, because I don't want all the time spent for him himself, because the boy is training hard, his family is spending time for him, and his dream, and maybe wasted just for a little bit too impatience.
So what will it be like next year when you've got James Knox to follow and also Charlie Quarterman to follow? You'll have a couple of names to keep an eye on as the results come in and when the races are on TV.
Sure enough. For me, it's just perfect, isn't it? That's what I want. I want more and more of those boys be there and sharing those lovely experiences. You know, whatever goes, we did it. You know, and
that's the currency for success, isn't it, Flavio? When you can see your guys going through the ranks and ending up in World Tour teams, that's what gives you the greatest pleasure and success.
Well, it's also to tell the boys that that's the possibility, and it's there for everyone, and it's to do with training, it's to do with lifestyle, it's to do with commitment, it's to do with passion, and focusing on those issues. And a lot of time, because of social media, because commercial issues, the boys are deviated to things which are not necessary. And I'm talking about gadgets now, talking about things which deviate the focus. One old ex-pro from Portugal, it was 75 at the time, and I went in there to see him, because I like to go to Expo and talk to them, and I said, "Well, what do you think about nowadays?" I said, and he said in Portuguese at the time, "Nowadays they're putting a chimney before making the foundation of the house," and that's exactly what I tried to explain to the boys. You need to do the foundation, because the stronger they are, you can make as many chimneys you want afterwards, isn't it?
Well, Flavio, that seems like the perfect place to leave our conversation for today. You're kind of the site foreman. You're there manning the cement mixer to get the ingredients to start building those foundations. And I guess that work will continue in 2020.
Yeah, 2020 will be good. As I said earlier on, we've got a bigger team lots of help from the families, but also this year, like last year, from the boss of Planetex and with the brand Oldorf Bikes, which he obviously is one of the only few people helping us, providing all the kit that we need to race abroad, that actually believes in what we're doing, other than this man here, and some other little sponsors as well. You know, we got four or five sponsors, which they've been there all the time, small sponsor. Planetex is going to give us a lot of bicycle, a lot of kit, which is necessary for us for the future. So, yeah, 2020 will be interesting. 2020, 20 riders, five different nations, New Zealand, Australia, Denmark, Ireland, Norway, and UK. So we got about three or four regularly racing for the national team. So they start believing in more and more in us. Team Wiggins closing down. It helped us sourcing more riders. To be honest, my dream is to have 40 riders in the future. And because I got a calendar to provide a lot of races for a lot of boys, I just need to have more people with me to help me, and a bigger setup, and a couple of sponsors more, and I can probably give all those opportunities.
Well, Flavio and Paul, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much. Good chatting.
Ciao.
Well, not somebody I knew an awful lot about, Lionel, but very interesting to meet Flavio Zappi and hear his story.
Yeah, very interesting, actually, and particularly his attitude towards developing young riders and the model that he's developed. You know, he's very transparent about how that model works, and it's obviously been successful for riders. And I can't help but think that the likes of James Knox and now Charlie Quarterman getting World Tour contracts, having come through Zappi's team, is going to stand them in good stead. But I imagine, you know, it's a constant battle to keep funding a program that takes the riders all around Europe throughout the year.
Indeed, and fascinating to hear his stories of the 84 Giro as well. One that sort of stands out as one of the more famous editions of that race, I guess, with all the controversy around Francesco Moser's win, and one of these races that certainly sticks in my mind. So really interesting to hear from him. As we said at the start, we have launched our Friends program for 2020. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe. It's a new system. It works tremendously well. Jonathan Rowe, who's worked managing the Friends program for several years for us and does all our social media and stuff as well, has done a fantastic job developing that, and it's had a lot of good feedback from you. So thanks very much, everyone who has signed up as a friend of the podcast, and please do so to support what we do and support our plans for next year. And also our spin-off shows, Service Course, is out later this week. There'll be a new episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina in the new year. There was one released last week as well. And I think a new series of Explorer coming next year as well, Lionel?
Yes, indeed. Well, I can probably break this news now. The Explorer will return in January and will be a monthly show, just like the other... just like Service Course and the Cycling Podcast Femina. So Explore will return in January. More on that in the new year. Looking forward to getting stuck into that, certainly. Are we going to hear a clip?
Let's hear a clip from episode 2 for Friends of the Podcast for 2020. This is a mashup of our live shows recently, and that will be released later this week or the start of next week. So here's a little clip from it now.
I'm quite impressed we've made it to stage 5. No one's pulled out of the race just yet. All us in the sparkly leader's leggings. But it's not who's wearing them on stage 5, is it? It's who's got them on by the end of the grand tour.
Good luck. Yeah. You're more than welcome to give it a go.
How stretchy are they?
I mean, the Grand Tours were obviously fantastic, but that moment when Lizzie Deignan crossed the line in Wales and she'd won her first race, actually, since coming back and having a child, was a wonderful moment. When she crossed the line, well, she wasn't in tears, but she was very emotional. She had tears in her eyes, and I was one of the first people to put a recorder underneath her face and, you know, ask her how it all went. And there was a crowd of people gathered around, and she said, I'm just really relieved. I'm so emotional. I've been trying not to think about Orla all week. And everybody looked at me as if I'd done something to you. I'm like, that's the name of her daughter. It's because she's a mum now.
I'm really puzzled because there's two typed questions. I mean, who's brought a typewriter here this evening?
Came back and the podcast was still going. Daniel had managed
still gone,
to...
Still gone from strength to
strength. Well, you managed to press record at least one of the days, hasn't you?
Yeah. It was a bit of a dump, as I remember it, Napalm. You put some equipment, some electrical equipment I'd never seen before on the back seat and said, good luck. And then your Italian became fluent suddenly. In bocca al lupo. Ciao. Ci vediamo.
Do you not pay attention when we're recording the
not
podcast
really,
to
no.
see how it
no,
works?
Not really.
No. Well, you did manfully. You got through. Kept the podcast alive.
I love how you've changed microphones and everything.
Reluctant. Yeah, it changes everything, doesn't it? Allons enfants de la patrie, le jour de gloire est arrivé. Contre nous de la tyrannie, l'étendard sanglant est levé. L'étendard sanglant est levé. Entendez-vous dans nos campagnes?
What on earth is this?
Well, line up, the brief for this week was bring some of your favourite kits. He didn't mention cycling. So that's Ivan Lendl's jersey, shirt for the 1987 Wimbledon, which is one of my favourite kits of all time.
Who is the Ivan Lendl of cycling?
It's got to be Rog, hasn't it?
That was a little clip from our new friend special out very soon. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com/subscribe. Your support helps all the stuff that we do and will help us next year cover the Grand Tours in the way that we normally do. So thank you very much in advance if you're just thinking about it.
Well, we've got one regular episode still to come. That will be even more different than the trip to Nice last week, Richard, and my interview with Flavio Zappi. Real Christmas flavoured episode coming early next week, just in time for Christmas, but we'll obviously be online between Christmas and New Year. Might even spark and inspire other people to see whether they can do better than us. I'll leave it at that. I mean, if that doesn't whet appetites, I don't know what will.
I'm really looking forward to our afternoon in the pub on Friday with Ned Bolting, who's joining us for this experiment, podcasting experiment. Finally, before we go this week, some thank yous to some of the first people who've signed up as friends of the podcast for 2020. Thank you very much to Ben Dool, to Moyin Islam, to Kevin Sweeney, to Robert Hill, Christopher Leach, Matthew Ray, James Pellet, Martin Wastey, James Mon, and Gustav Orstrom. And finally, if you'd like to give somebody the gift of a Friend of the Podcast subscription, that facility is now available. It's the perfect Christmas present for the cycling podcast listener who doesn't quite have everything, or the perfect solution to a last-minute Christmas shopping crisis, because it can be ordered very simply online and we'll take care of the rest. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com for details. But that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.